Welcome to Indie Radio Garden. This week, highlight from Community Radio in the Philadelphia region.
This program brings ordinary citizens to the air to discuss issues related to health, race, safety, workers' rights, and the will to survive in pandemic times.
The first audio is from WRGULP 92.9, Germantown United CDC. David Juro hosts a neighborly chat, interviews Sandra Girolli, director of Philadelphia Operation for the Paul USA, a nonprofit which houses and serves the needed of Philadelphia's homeless, housing insecure.
Listening to Neighborly Chats on WRGU 92.9 FM. Today we're talking to Sandra Guillory from DePaul USA, a nonprofit that houses and serves the needs of the homeless.
I'm Sandra Guillory. I'm the director of Philadelphia programs for DePaul USA. I've worked for DePaul for 12 years now. DePaul USA is located in 7 cities, mostly across the eastern United States, where we provide services to folks who are homeless and housing insecure. And we try and fill gaps in those cities in their services. We're at the old Immaculate Conception Church on Sprague in Shelton, which is the church that looks like a basilica. It's beautiful. And we're in the former convent of that church. Our other locations are St. Raymond's of Penafort in East Mount Airy near Cedarbrook Mall. And we have a location in West Oak Lane at this former St. Athanasius Convent.
Sandra told me that DePaul USA was not in fact formed in the USA and is one branch of a larger international organization combating homelessness.
So DePaul USA started 30 years ago in the United Kingdom as a response to rising homelessness in England in the 1980s. They saw an increasing number of young people who were becoming homeless. And so DePaul UK formed. It spawned other organizations. They were invited to Ireland, Slovakia, Ukraine, and eventually the United States. So DePaul goes where it's been invited to help serve. And we work with the Vincentians, hence the name DePaul USA. And in Germantown here, there's a 250-year history of the Vincentians who have been in East Germantown at the seminary, and the Daughters of Charity have worked in many of the schools and hospitals here. So they invited DePaul USA to form at the old Gabray Michael Inn on Sprague Street in Shelton. And we formed a transitional housing program for homeless men back in 2009. So from that, we've grown, and we now have 5 different programs here in Philadelphia. We've grown from that one site on Sprague Street to 7 cities across the eastern United States. So we work a lot with local religious organizations, and we work under the theory, at least in Philadelphia, of YGBI. Yes, in God's backyard. So trying to reuse former church buildings so that they serve their purpose of a social service agency, because there's definitely a need to innovatively address homelessness and to help people where they're at and help them with dignity so that they can exit homelessness.
Sandra went further to describe how the services they offer, as well as their values, differentiate DePaul USA from other organizations helping the homeless in the city.
DePaul USA works a lot on values. So believe in rights, responsibilities. We believe in dignity and respect. And we believe in being innovative unto infinity, in the words of St. Vincent de Paul. So that means on the ground that our buildings are on the smaller side. We're not trying to serve a couple hundred people a day. We're trying to serve, on average, about 27 people in our buildings. Folks can stay as long as they need to. So our programs range from transitional to rapid rehousing to permanent supportive housing. And the idea is we are going to walk with someone and help them to achieve whatever their goals are. And those goals are probably not achievable in a couple of weeks, but maybe in a couple of months, and maybe in some cases a couple of years. So they become part of our family and we become part of theirs. So We've had some great success. Our transitional housing program, DePaul House, the one on Sprague Street, we've served over 350 people in 12 years. And in that time, 80% of the folks who've come through our doors have graduated, which means they've left to a job, housing, and a savings account. So I think our model works, and it's really refreshing when former residents come back and ask for services. Sometimes they just want help with updating their resumes or getting a form of identification. Sometimes they just come back for a meal and to say hi. So definitely impacting people's lives more deeply than an organization where people just come for food.
I also learned that DePaul USA is part of the same family of organizations as the Philadelphia Interfaith Hospitality Network, which is an organization that Neighborly Chat spoke with a couple weeks prior to my interview with Sandra.
We're both homeless service organizations in the northwest of Philadelphia. They focus more on families, and we work mostly with single adults. We have a couple of families we work with in our rapid rehousing program. So we don't overlap in terms of like competition, but we look to them for advice and guidance. We turn to Rachel Falcove, who works in the Chestnut Hill office, to ask them about how we can move forward with various projects we're looking at. They have their tiny house village that they're working on, which I find fascinating. And we all should share our best practices. So while we're not pursuing a tiny house village here in Philadelphia, one of our other city sites might do so as well. So we'll turn to them to see what kind of progress they're making as well.
Sandra and I spoke about the importance of being sensitive to trauma, which is something that many of DePaul USA's clients are all too familiar with.
Yeah, so one of the frameworks that we use is we try to be trauma-informed, recovery-oriented, and client-centered. Those are our buzzwords. And so in terms of trauma, it means making a space that feels welcoming. So folks who've been homeless have been through lots of other institutions before they've gotten to us. And maybe when they walked through those doors, they didn't feel like they were welcomed there. They may have been a burden to the folks who were supposed to be serving them. So having lots of plants. Two of our buildings have cats because we find that if someone sees things that are alive in a building, they know that they're being taken care of, and maybe they will be also taken care of. We try to be affirming to the residents who walk through our door, so their rights and responsibilities are posted prominently so they know that we're also accountable to the Office of Homeless Services or whoever is funding us. The other part of being trauma-informed is recognizing that sometimes a person's reaction is a symptom of their coping skills and not necessarily who that person is. It's what has happened to the person. And so instead of asking what's wrong with you, we ask what's happened to you. And we try not to punish people for the reactions, but to help them grow so that they can have better coping reactions. So it means that we have to be patient. We ask that the clients be patient with each other because sometimes they'll blow up. And we look to restorative justice as a way to help clients heal the wounds between each other. We ask very few people to leave our buildings. We really try and work with them so that they're given second, third, and fourth chances, assuming, of course, no one else's health or safety is at risk.
I asked Sandra if there are any memorable people that she met while working at DePaul USA that she'd like to talk about, either a client or a coworker or someone else.
It was our coworker, Vernon Tolbert. He just passed away. He worked with us starting, I think, from year one or two. I remember he started working with us in January. And he started off as an on-call residential aide, which meant he kind of came in as needed, one or two shifts per week. And we quickly promoted him to full-time residential aide. And then he became our operations, which is facility supervisor, and eventually a full-time cook. He worked with us for over 8 years. And in that time, he kind of embodied what I want our work to be. He would take residents aside and like counsel them and talk to them for 2-3 hours at a time. He'd show them how to make chicken because we'd have residents who said, I'm too embarrassed to admit I don't know how to cook and I don't know how to feed myself. He would show people how to play football in the back so that they could then play it with their kids, who they're trying to reconnect with. And so I tell you what his job description was, but it doesn't encompass what he did, which is he really, whatever a resident needed, he would try to address it. He would try and do it without making the person feel embarrassed about not knowing how to do a thing. Oh, he gave guys haircuts. So before they would go on job interviews, he would make sure that they were shaped up nicely so that they would feel proud of themselves. So he left DePaul a couple years ago. He would always come back, checking on the residents, checking on his former colleagues. And unfortunately, he passed away from heart failure earlier this year. But he's the kind of person that I want our staff and our residents to look up to.
Of course, I asked about the last year and about how DePaul USA had to adapt to the pandemic.
I guess one of the biggest things we had to change is one of our core principles around our work is that peers, our clients, support each other. And so we have a lot of group programming where people can come to a room and talk about what's going on in their lives, and their neighbors and their other residents will help them to figure out how to address it and help draw out their own strengths. So we can't do that because we can't bring people together into a room. The other challenge is we have always served meals family style. So residents come together, they can select and choose amongst what we are serving in a buffet, and then they can eat at a table with people they want to eat dinner with. And so we can't do that. So the biggest changes have been moving most of our case management work to individual work. So it's clients and case managers working one-on-one to try and address whatever's going on. Our case managers have worked on-site the entire time. We've never worked from home. So that means dealing with our clients' anxiety and their fears around the pandemic, as well as our own, has been one of the biggest challenges. Happy to report that we have had 4 cases of COVID in our buildings, but no outbreaks. That means that one person got sick but never spread it to anyone else, because our staff have also done a really good job of making sure that everyone stays safe. And then in terms of meals, it means we've used a lot of plastic and paper products because we've moved everything to single-serve meals. We're still trying to keep things dignified, but unfortunately, we have to pre-wrap everything now. We had groups outside during last summer, so people can still support each other. We can still have meetings. And then I'm happy to report also that we've been able to offer our clients the vaccine since about mid-February, and somewhere near 80% of our staff have been vaccinated, as well as 80% of the residents who are in our buildings. So things feel much safer as well. And the CDC has advised that folks can meet if they're vaccinated indoors. So we've been able to bring some groups back.
Finally, I asked about the impact that DePaul USA is trying to have on the community around it.
Yeah, we definitely want to have a positive impact, of course. At our St. Raymond's and DePaul House sites, we have organic gardens that are staffed and volunteered by our residents and some of our neighbors. And so in this year, where a lot of other community groups have come out and had a lot of food to offer, we've gotten a lot of that as well, and we want to offer it to our neighbors. So at both of our buildings, we have benches and food pantries outside, so any of our neighbors can stop by and take the food that's there that we can't use. In terms of the wider community, I hope to be able to show how it is challenging to address homelessness in a way that is client-centered and holistic, but that our success rate, I think, kind of demonstrates that if you do that, you can have a positive impact on people's lives, and they ideally never have to return to homelessness or to that trauma again in the future. So in our 12 years of existence, we've impacted, hopefully positively, over 1,000 lives across all of our sites.
If you're interested in upcoming events or learning more about DePaul USA,
we have a scavenger hunt. We've done this in person for the last 5 or 6 years. Of course, this year we're not going to do it in person. It'll be an online scavenger hunt. And people will be able to go outside wherever they are in teams and compete against other teams for prizes. So that should be live sometime in June. And people can go to our website, www.depaulusa.org, for more information.
That website again is www.depaul.org. I'd like to thank Sandra Guillory and DePaul USA for talking to me, and I'd also like to thank you, the listener, for tuning in. My name is David Juro, and you've been listening to Neighborly Chats on WRGU 92.9 FM.
WHGELP 95.3, Afro-American Historical Society of Delaware. Scrap Radio, Pavel Uranga, interviews. Mr. Harmon Carey, founder of WHGE, about the experience of growing up in a society that does not accept you because of your skin color, racial discrimination, and white privilege are the topic of this interview.
Welcome. We are interviewing Mr. Harmon Carey from WHGE LP 95.3 FM from Delaware, from the Afro-American Historical Society. And we are doing this interview to take some minutes on empathy to understand racism, racial discrimination, hatred, the personal way to live on a particular skin. How is the wages when you start working? Is the same?
Interesting you should ask. We encountered some serious obstacles when it came to gaining work and employment opportunities as children, as youth. There were only, I'll tell you the jobs that were available to us. First of all, you could work in a grocery store, helping to stock and clean and sweep the sidewalk. And some of my friends did this. Most all of the grocery stores were owned by Jewish merchants. That was one job open. Another job that was open was setting up pins in bowling alleys. This was before they had the automatic pin setters. So boys would be at the end of the bowling lane and they would stand up high. And some of them got hit by pins that were flying, but that was just one of the hazards of that particular job. But blacks couldn't bowl in those alleys that the pin boys worked in. There was only one bowling alley, and that was at the Walnut Street YMCA. They had a four-lane bowling alley for black bowlers. You could, if you had a wagon, you could help people home with their groceries from the few, it was two or three markets. It was an Acme, a Giant Tiger, and something else. And the other one was being a shoeshine boy. And of those things, I was a shoeshine boy. And as a shoeshine boy, I encountered racism. And I can think of a number of examples of it. First of all, we had to make our own boxes, our own shoeshine kits, shoeshine boxes. So they weren't, you know, very durable. We did the best that we could. But the police, when they saw us in the train station or on Market Street shining shoes, if they got to us before we saw them, if we saw them, we would leave. But if they got up on us, instead of just saying, you boys can't shine shoes here, they would kick our boxes to break them. And that happened enough times for us. We'd have lookouts to see when the police were coming. Shoe shines then were 15 cents. And if you were lucky, you got a nickel tip. And that was great, you know, 20 cents. When it would be five or six of us at the same corner. And as people approached, we would yell out, I got this one, I got that one. So that, you know, we had our own little system. So once we'd say, shine, mister, shine. We didn't say shoe shine. But at times the would-be patron would say something like this, shine? Who are you calling a shine? You're a shine. Well, we think they knew that we weren't calling them shine, but that was something that they said. Then they had this notion that if you rubbed the head of a black person, it would bring you good luck. And they would ask, can I rub your head? I'll give you an extra dime and that kind of thing. we didn't know that that was demeaning. We didn't. But now I know that. I would have said, go F yourself then, but I didn't know it then. So if he wanted to touch my hair and give me a quarter, it was fine. And this was this ignorance and lack of sensibilities that we had as we were young. We were just kids, maybe 13, 14 years old.
May I ask you, how about walking on the streets, let's say in downtown, on a regular day, being you a teenager would wants to buy an ice cream? You can do that?
Well, it depends on where you wanted to buy the ice cream or where you wanted to buy this, a sandwich, for example, for lunch. There were certain places that wouldn't serve you. For example, the 5 and 10 said counters, lunch counters. Well, we couldn't go to that lunch counter and eat. We could go to the end of the lunch counter and put an order in and take it out to eat it. The white kids were sitting there having banana splits and milkshakes and so forth, and they all looked so good, but we were denied that opportunity. The downtown business district was centered in Wilmington on a street called Market Street, and there were restaurants, there were 5 and 10s, there were movie theaters. Thinking of movie theaters, Blacks could not go to the movie theaters in Wilmington when I grew up. There were a number of movie theaters, the Rialto down at 3rd and Market, the Town at 6th and Market, the Queen at 5th and Market, but none of them would accept Black patronage. We only had one movie that we could go to, one theater, and that was the National that was owned by a family named Hopkins. We could only go to the Black theater. My wife is from Augusta, Georgia, and she and her friends could go to the white theater, though they sat on the same level, but they had a curtain, like the whites would sit on the left and the Blacks would sit on the right, and they would have a curtain dividing them. So they were able to see the same movie in the same room, but they were separated by a curtain.
I was also a shining shoe boy.
You shined shoes when you were young?
Yeah, when I was 5 years old.
Do you remember how much a shoe shine was?
Yeah, we charged 10 cents for every shine in Mexico. I used to go to the train stations to 5:30 a.m. to wait for the workers who want to take the train and me to clean their shoes. And,
yes.
then I clean their shoes and they give me some cents. They don't give any tips because they are workers, poor workers.
Right, I understand.
And I have those cents and then I put it in my pocket and I went to the school at 8 a.m. after being working since your son's rise and with anything in my belly and that things is, yeah, you're remembering me things I've been living my whole life.
Another experience that I had, the YMCA in Wilmington operated a camp called Camp Taqua. And it was a camp, an overnight camp on the Chesapeake Bay where the students, the boys, would reside in cabins during the two-week camping experience. The Black students went to a camp called Camp Brown. There were no cabins. We stayed in tents. There were no toilet facilities. We had to dig a latrine. The water came to us through a hose. But our family, at one point, really couldn't afford to pay the fee. So a buddy of mine and I got together and we decided one weekend to go up to the area where the camp was and to just stay overnight ourselves. And we went up there and we were able to find a place off of Concord Avenue in Wilmington. And we had a pup tent and we pitched our pup tent and we went swimming. one afternoon. And when we went there, these white teenagers came to the swimming hole. And the teenage boys started to torment me and my buddy. His name was Calvin. And they were calling us all kinds of names. You niggers, what are you doing here? Get away. We eventually just stopped swimming and went on back up land to our pup tents where we fixed dinner. But it was interesting that they were with teenage girls, and the girls were actually scolding the boys, telling them, well, you shouldn't talk to them that way and that. And so these were the boys, getting mad because their white girlfriends were on our side instead of agreeing with them.
The decency doesn't have to do with the being white or black, or if you are decent or not. Do these kind of things is not right. And even with the kids, it's more easy to teach everybody that racial discrimination is nonsense because it's unfair. It's something with no sense, and people can realize because they don't have this heavy wave of the white privilege on their shoulders to nullify this sense of, that's unfair, I don't care.
It's really a disease, and some aspects of it folks are very much aware of. But in some ways, Pavel, I believe that whites, especially young, don't really understand. They don't know any better. They were told generation after generation. Their great-grandmothers told their children, and their children, the mothers told their children that black people are inferior, that you are superior. It's drilled in their heads. So they grew up believing some of this. Now, some went on and learned from their own experiences that those things were not true. And they began to look at black people in a different way. But some of them still are suffering under the same illusions that they have been other prior generations have suffered. And it's regrettable.
Thanks for joining us. My name is Bessie Miranda, and I'm the host of the show Sexist Here, or Filatinos and Spanish radio station. Indie Radio Garden is a Prometheus Radio Project's production.